Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable.
Being an American requires being able to hold two opposing thoughts. You know, I hate what you say and I defend your right to say it.
Singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash contemplating what it means to be an American. She's part of our series in which writers and musicians, activists and more reflect on American identity. Here's what Native American activist and poet Jossie Ross told me about that.
The one thing that we can agree on is that at one time, America was aspirational. And those aspirations, you know, they might have been right or they might have been wrong. They might have been not fully inclusive, but they were aspirational. They were willing to consider evolution.
The whole series of conversations are on my podcast or at NPR News with Carrie Miller, including the call-in show with anthropologist Jose Santos. This hour, three smart people on the roundtable take up the question. Paku Hung, executive director of the Hmong American Farmers Association. Welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Carrie.
Naima Khan, philanthropy fellow at the Bush Foundation. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Carrie.
Brian Rosenberg is president of McAllister College. And welcome. Long time no see. Good to have you back.
Happy to be here.
Brian, I'm throwing the tough one here that I've thrown to all of the guests, first to you because you're an educator and you're used to, you know, sending out wisdom to your students. I've opened this series with my guests by pointing the guests to a poem by Langston Hughes called Let America Be America Again, and a specific phrase in the second stanza that reads, Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot of bitterness in this poem. What does that phrase say to you?
If you had asked me that question a couple of years ago, I might have given you a simpler and maybe a more glib answer. But as I ponder the events in this country over the last couple of years, it really highlights for me that, as one of your earlier guests said, the heart of this country is its aspiration, mm-hmm. and we're still very much in the process of trying to achieve that aspiration. We are not there yet. And so when I read that, and I know that poem very well, it's a powerful poem. And what it speaks to is the fact that on the one hand, the dream of America, the goals of America, the ideals of America are inspirational, not just to the people in this country, but to everyone around the world. On the other hand, the reality of America from the time of its founding to the current moment is not aligned entirely with those aspirations. And I think as a country, we simply have to come to grip with that gap between what we aspire to be, which is terrific, and what we in fact are, and not take for granted that we have come to the end of the journey because we haven't.
Naima, what does that phrase, let America be the dream the dreamers dream, say to you?
Very much resonate with what Brian talked about here. Just really kind of seems like the aspirational piece is really big and core, and kind of the way that we think about what it means to be American kind of at that allegorical level, right? Mm-hmm. So you have some mythology kind of associated with land of opportunity, you know, rags to riches, this idea of, you know, pulling yourself up by the bootstraps and that anybody can really make it here. And I think what we've seen in with recent events is just this really jadedness that comes about because you see the realities, right? You see, the injustices that exist and kind of the systemic challenges that we have to deal with still and have conversations around. And you know that it's so far from that ideal, from that mythology. And so part of it is about how do we get rid of the parts of the mythology that don't serve us well anymore? And part of it is about how do we move the conversation forward so that for those aspirations that we do hold, that we can actually make progress.
I think Paku, Naima has really put her finger on something here that's come out in the series, which is we want to believe the idealism of the country, but But to improve it, we have to acknowledge that we are failing a lot of people and failing in a lot of ways. And that's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to be self-critical like that. What do you hear in it?
Well, I think two things. The first is that, you know, in that stanza that we just said, and what Naima, you just said, if we think that of America as a geography or a place or a people, mm-hmm. or if we think of it as ideas, then the ideas themselves are this normative and we can aspire to them. And in that way, you can have, like what Roseanne was saying, you can have two conflicting tensions. You can have a love for the ideas and want to aspire to the ideas, but you can also say, but I also know that the current conditions are not true. And how do we lift what is current to what we can believe can be true? But you're right. I mean, the American dream is not available to everybody in America. But I think the American dream is still really powerful. And I think that is still part of the American spirit, is to have this aspiration that everybody can do better socially, economically. I mean, I think about my parents and how they came to this country. They couldn't speak any English. They didn't have any type of formal education. And here they are. They have children. They have their own house, but they have children who are self-sufficient, who've gone to some of the best schools. And so, or I look at our president. You know, I look at our president, Barack Obama, and you know, all the things he's done. So, yes, there are a lot of things that are still really wrong with our country that we have to improve on. But there are also great things that do make America great. And I think Langston Hughes' poem, you know, at the end, even though you're right, it's very bitter. At the end, it's actually very optimistic.
I know. Surprisingly. Just one question before we delve into that. Do you think the idealism that your parents have about what America is sounds pretty different from whatever idealism their children, you and your siblings, possess about it?
That's such a good question. You know, I think that one of the reasons why I think this country needs immigrants, we are a country of immigrants, except for our Native American brothers and sisters. But I think one of the great things that immigrants bring to this country are the possibilities having known an other. Uh-huh. And that's what my parents bring. You know, they lived through a war. They were in a society where oftentimes Hmong people had to walk on their knees, right, to go down to the low-level parts of Laos. And so compared to that, America had so many possibilities for not just them, but for their children. I remember in 1986, there was a Hmong grandfather, and he said this to a National Geographic reporter. He said, "I have never left my village in Laos, and I'm going to a strange country to live and die. But America will be good for my children," because they say all children can go to school there. And so just that opportunity to have an education and to prove yourself, that is the idealism my parents have. I think my brothers and sisters and I, we are more Hmong American, where, you know, we understand the realities of being a minority in this country, where your race still has a huge influence on what you can do in life.
Mm-hmm. Naima, I saw you nodding as Paku was describing that.
Yeah, I think I was picking up on the comparative element there, Carrie, because so much of our parents' experience was kind of grounded in this. You know, this is the kind of stark reality here. You know, in my home country, things are not looking good for me in terms of prospects, whether that's economic or, you know, just opportunities for my children otherwise. And so a lot of the movement, I think that, well, you see, at least in my family and my extended family, was due to the sense that there's a really big potential here, right? And so I think whenever you're somewhere that's removed, it's easy to have kind of more romantic ideals of how, you know, the other place that you're going to get a better, you know, grounding is actually going to work. But it's interesting to kind of think about that comparative perspective.
Brian, to come back to what Paku said about how this poem, the bitterness and the tension and there is pessimism, there's darkness in that poem, because there are the dueling voices of let America be this, but then the other voice comes in to say America never was that. Paku sees hope and optimism at the end of it. Do you?
I do. And it speaks to me very powerfully about the current moment. So we are, I think, as everybody knows, in a very difficult moment right now and have been for some time. It has caused me to reevaluate in a pretty profound way my own understanding of this country.
How so?
You know, I've been privileged to be able to not pay attention to things that I think it's important that we all pay attention to. You know, as a white, male, educated person in a position of authority and with affluence, it's very easy for me to go through life and pretend that the aspirational America is the America for everyone. And if there's anything that is good that has come out of the last couple of years, it's sort of like exposing a wound to the air. No one, I think, at this moment in history can deny the fact that the inequalities that have long existed in this country, the ruptures, the racial tensions continue to exist. And so I think that on the one hand, it's been painful for me to have to wrestle with these things. On the other hand, I think it's been deeply healthy. And it has the potential to be deeply healthy for the country if people now are forced in a way they were not before to confront all the ways in which that American dream is not being realized for lots of people. And I think that's the spirit at the end of that poem.
I want to ask you this about the healthiness of that. I follow your logic. I wonder if the rancor of the discussion around getting to that place obscures the fact that this could be beneficial. Do you know what I'm asking?
Oh, yeah. And it depends on which day you catch me. So there are some days when I just feel almost despondent about it, about those deep, deep divisions, and about the worse angels of our nature, that certain people in our political life and in our public life have drawn out of people. But you have to hold on to hope. I mean, I think you have to. And I think that as I talk to people, I've come to the realization that it has been, for a lot of people, like for me, a very important revelation, a very important reminder, and could lead, doesn't necessarily, we always have to make choices, but it could lead to healthier and more honest public discourse and better public policy as we move forward. But it's in our hands. It could also not lead there.
Paku Naima, what would you say?
I mean, I think the divisiveness of the rhetoric, particularly on kind of the national scale, is it impacts people. Whether we like it or not, it impacts kind of the frame of reference that we have as individuals in terms of what's possible. And the two kind of avenues, or, you know, right now we have a two-party system. So really the two avenues that are approaches that are in the mix and when it comes to discussing how we actually are to achieve this American dream. Now, what's interesting is that I've noticed in my own kind of personal conversations, a lot of people pick up on this divisiveness and really people are tired of it. And I think that people are seeking solutions and people are of the mind that they want to have more nuanced conversations. I think how that happens and how that gets raised and elevated in kind of our civic discourse is a different question.
Paku?
Carrie, I really agree with both what Naima and Brian were saying. I'm reminded that during the Democratic National Convention, when the Kahn family were speaking and there
yes.
was all that controversy, and I remember thinking—
This is the Gold Star family, we should say, who lost a son in Iraq.
That's right. And I remember reading all the comments. And, you know, you rarely should read the comments because it's just nasty. But I remember reading the Washington Post and reading the comments and just crying because there were so many people who were saying, Ms. Kahn, I have lost a child, or Ms. Kahn. And they were supporting her. They were lifting up that family. And I thought, this is the America that I have to have and I do have faith in. And so I think, Brian, to your point, like, we do have a very tense situation right now. And we have faith in the better angels, but of course, there's always a little bit of a caution, like, is that really going to happen? But when I'm reminded of all those comments, I think there are good people in America. And I want to say another thing. You know, I'm a political science by training. Mm-hmm. And when this is all happening, I'm thinking very much of Alex Tocqueville and how 1840, you know, he's traveling this country and he writes in Democracy in America, but how this country is really unique compared to his own country, France, because he says we are a country that for some crazy reason join associations and we get together and we think that if there's a problem, then we as a group can do that and we talk and, you know, that civil discourse, that robust civic society makes us able to be a democracy with a small d, or really a representative republic, right? And I think in that same way, we are having these this discourse, albeit it's on Twitter, right? Or albeit it's in the comment section. But it is happening, and maybe through that, you know, really intense and robust discourse, we will come out with something that is the ideals of America, I hope.
When you talk about feeling despondent, and I hear what Paku and Naima say, I think we can't be swamped by the despair. And I think it is an essentially American thing to see beyond, I hope, the despair. I hope we still have that.
Yeah, and I feel a particular responsibility as an educator.
Yeah.
I'm surrounded by 2,000 18 to 22-year-olds who are trying to make sense of all of this. And it is a leadership challenge unlike any that I think I faced in all the time I've been at McAllister. Because on the one hand, we have many students. We have many Muslim students. We have many students of color. We have many students who just care about these things, who are feeling anger, who are feeling afraid. And it's really important that we acknowledge all of those feelings, that we tell them we know how you feel. But it's also important that we not just leave them there, that we have to try to lift them up out of that and suggest that the work that they do in their lives, the work that they do even while they're at McAllister, can make a difference, that there is a possibility to make these things better. And there are communities that don't reject them, and there are communities that don't meet them with hate, but that embrace them. And that this is not a unique moment in American history, but American history is filled with moments that we look back on and think, how did we do that?
Yeah.
And so finding the right balance as someone who is trying to educate a generation of students who will make this country and this world better than it is now, finding the right balance between acknowledging all the negativity but giving them hope is something that I can't think about once a week or once a month. I have to think about it every day.
I was listening to something that Justice Sonia Sotomayor was saying at the University of Minnesota, one of the members of the Supreme Court. And she said she's asked quite often from young people who come from families where perhaps one of the parents is undocumented or they're relatively new to this country. And I loved her words about this because they speak to what you were saying, Brian. She says to them, show up, basically act like a citizen who has a stake in the future of this country. I mean, that's kind of what you're saying to these students. You cannot let the despondence around this swamp any kind of showing up that you have to do.
And there's a real risk of that. I mean, one of the things we've seen at McAllister, and it's counterintuitive at a school that is so socially engaged, but that our students don't vote.
What?
In the numbers that they should. So in the 2012 election, 75% of our students were registered to vote, which makes sense given the percentage of international students we have. But only 45% of our students actually voted. And it's not that they're not engaged in every other way in our civic life, but they are losing faith in their ability to affect things through the exercise of the vote. And we have to convince them that it matters. We have to convince them that there are lots of different ways to affect positive social change, but one of them, one of the important ones, is to participate in the political process. And I think we're seeing in this particular generation of young people a disillusionment with traditional politics, and that I think is, for all of its weaknesses, it is very risky if those people opt out.
My guess is that, Naima, you've given some thought to this.
Yes. I'm just thinking about all the layers, right? So you have first the kind of racial tensions. So race is one layer. You have the economic picture, which is totally, you know, it's so hard to disregard that given the income inequality and just the rate at which the inequality exists. And then you have this piece about governance and how folks are thinking and seeing themselves as agents of change and making change within these systems that, you know, people kind of talk about. Yes, you know, institutionalized racism, and we have this kind of concept, I think, collectively that systems somehow need to change. But then it's, you know, what is that level of efficacy? And I feel like as long as we have kind of the current kind of traditional modes of leadership, I should say, it seems like it's hard to see how people who are young with these fresh ideas and this really strong urgency, frankly, to change institutions are going to have that proper outlet.
Paku?
Yeah, you know, and Naima, when you were talking, I was thinking, you know, it's not just for citizens to go through these exercises, but also it's really beholden on all the institutions. So whether it's the university or these learning centers in our community, whether it's the media or journalism, to also rise up to these occasions and be strong in all these places so that we can have these robust conversations and unpack. Because I will be honest, I've really struggled with, you know, I'm a total supporter of free speech, and I really believe that let's have the ideas come and let's duke out the ideas. But something that's happened in this election cycle is where in the skies of I'm going to tell it like it is, we actually legitimize hate speech, right? And so where is that space? Where are those parameters where we say, let's have a really fruitful conversations and we bring our whole selves and our authentic selves. So if I'm someone from, you know, Appalachia and this is how I feel, then I'm going to say that. And I'm a Muslim from Minneapolis, what I'm going to say. But then where are those parameters when we're like, actually, no, that's not acceptable. You know, that's not American. And I feel like those are such fine lines. And so I know for myself, as, you know, as a leader in my own, you know, nonprofit, I struggle with that. Where are those, you know, what is my role to create those parameters that are free and flowing and supportive, but also say, but, you know, these things are acceptable and these are not acceptable.
Brian, how do you think about that?
It's as difficult right now, as challenging right now as any issue on college campuses, as you probably know, all over the country. There are debates right now on college campuses between the importance of free speech, between the importance of being confronted by ideas that you don't agree with and that are even challenging and difficult for you on the one hand, and creating an environment where students feel safe enough to learn, on the other hand. And my view is that it's a mistake to reduce it to a simple binary. It's not free speech or safety. I think it's a continuum, and I think every day you have to try to make judgments about what is and is not appropriate. You know, I very much agree that we just have to be able to say that there are certain discourse that is outside the bounds of what we consider appropriate civil discourse, that hate speech, that overt racism, that overt xenophobia, we should be able to call that out. People have the right to say it, but we also have the right to say that it is not tolerated or that it is wrong in a particular community. On the other hand, we have to acknowledge that people are going to say things always that we don't like.
I mean, this is what I was thinking as you were describing that is, One of the both double sides of the coin here for me in the kind of rhetoric that we've heard in the campaign is some speech, I'm going to say, from Donald Trump that has made me deeply uncomfortable. But I've also been heartened by the fact that there's an immediate calling out, mm-hmm. as you noted. There is an apathy around, maybe from some Americans, but for the most part, there's immediately people stepping into that space to say, not okay, and here's why. Mm-hmm. I think that's valuable, even though we have to kind of go through the muck to get to that place.
Mm-hmm. I think it's definitely valuable to have people call that out. And what I want to note, Carrie, is that I think it works both ways. I think within each party, there's a level of kind of, if you will, not being able to kind of tolerate the ideas that starkly disagree of the other
what,
side.
What are you thinking about there?
So there, you know, folks sometimes from like the strictly progressive point of view, mm-hmm. if there are, you know, ideals that are presented to them from, say, for example, Eastern traditions that don't quite match with the Western lens of, you know, gender equity, whatever the issue may be, like that becomes a sticking point. And right. if it's, I think it ultimately boils down to character on either side. If you're going to disagree with something in such a way that's antagonistic and your whole approach to the addressing the other side is that you've kind of given up on or have lost faith in that side, then I think the nature of the discourse turns sour. And I think that, you know, really bogs down any efforts to have a constructive dialogue.
I think one of the dangers of what we've seen over the last year is that somehow in the minds of some people, offensiveness has become synonymous with honesty.
I'm telling it like it is, right?
And yeah, that we just need to push back against that. There's a real difference between being honest and being offensive. You have the right in this country to be offensive. It is one of the burdens of free speech, and I think we have to bear that burden. But it's a real problem if the more offensive you are, the more honest you are perceived. And I think against that, we really have to push back.
I think that was the wrestling with the phrasing around, I don't go along with all this political correctness. Mm-hmm. There are a segment of Americans who hear that and say, I'm uncomfortable with the way things are changing. And so I like it when he verbalizes the kind of language that takes us back to when things were simpler and it was easier to tell who was American and who wasn't and those kinds of things.
Right. And of course, we know things weren't simpler.
Yes. Right.
The past to which some people hearken was a past that was, in my view, in most ways, worse than the present. I think that we've made progress on a lot of different issues having to do with gender equality and racial equality and treating people humanely who have different sexual orientations. We still have a long way to go, but the last thing I do is yearn for the 1950s or for the 1940s or really for any earlier era. And so when people yearn for that simpler time, I think what they yearn for is simply oblivion, a time when they didn't have to think about the things that because of the social changes we've gone through, they now have to think about.
I actually think, Brian, you're so right. And it actually goes to the very point of who is an American, right? Because for those folks who say, I wish we could be great again, that you know, there was a time when America was a utopia. That's a certain type of perspective. And oftentimes you can probably figure out a profile of that person because it probably wasn't a person of color. And so because America is changing demographically, we know that, you know, in a couple years, white people will not be the majority. We are in some immigrant communities, we're a very young community, so that's only going to grow. As America becomes more diverse and pluralistic society, that image of who is an American, this white, you know, guy or these white upper class people is definitely changing. And that is, I think, the tension, which is why this conversation to me is so exciting, because if we think of America as just those profiles of geography or mm-hmm. people, that's very different from if we think America is an idea and the idea that free people come together and together they can govern themselves. That's dynamic. That's timeless. And that is something that we'll probably never be able to reach.
There's a great line, though, in an English poem by Robert Browning, in which he says that, and he uses 19th century gendered language, but he says, a man's reach should exceed his grasp or what's a heaven for.
Mm.
You should always aspire to that which you can never quite reach.
You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's part of our ongoing series of what it means to be an American. I've been talking with activists and writers and musicians and now our roundtablers today about the essence of that ideal and the idea at the center of American identity. Naima Khan is with us. She's philanthropy fellow at the Bush Foundation, Paku Hong, executive director of the Hmong American Farmers Association, and Brian Rosenberg, president of McAllister College.
Let America be the dream. The dream is dream. That is a nostalgic line, I think, that that assumes something was in place that perhaps never was in place. And it makes me think of Thomas Jefferson and the way he always felt that given the way white Americans treated blacks, that our relations would always be contentious. So I'm not quite sure which America Langston Hughes was referring back to, because the strifes were there initially and they continue to be there now.
It's poet and writer Claudia Rankine reflecting on one of the questions that I've asked all of our guests for this What It Means to Be an American series, which is, what does this phrase, what does this line from Langston Hughes' poem, Let America Be America Again, really mean? And Claudia Rankine there reflecting on Let America Be the Dream the Dreamers Dreamed. This is the Friday Roundtable. We're pondering that question. Brian Rosenberg with us from McAllister College. Naima Khan with us, a fellow at the Bush Foundation. And Paku Hong with us from the Hmong American Farmers Association. Brian, I feel like you alluded to this, and I wanted to follow up on this in the first part of the discussion. How do you think class and geography influences the way Americans today think would answer this question that we're contemplating?
Well, if you believe all of the polls and all of the research that's being done, the simple answer is a lot. I think that there seems to be a growing division, at least at this particular moment, between a coalition that I would describe as people of color and people who are more educated, and then people who are less educated and people who are in certain sections of the country, in particular where they don't have exposure, direct exposure to diverse communities. The most interesting—
Is that what you think it is?
Well, the most interesting thing I've read about Donald Trump supporters is that, contrary to a lot of the early assumptions, they don't in fact tend to be, for the most part, sort of those dispossessed working class people. They tend to be people who on average have socioeconomic levels that are above the median. And most important, they tend to come from communities where they don't have a lot of exposure to diversity. That is, they tend to come from very homogeneous communities. My feeling, and this may be overly optimistic, but my feeling is that the more exposure people have to diverse communities, the more likely they are to develop empathy and tolerance. If you live in a community that's homogeneous, you're more likely to develop fear and suspicion. And so for me right now, the big division is between people who in their daily lives get to see people who are different from them as human beings, with the same hopes as them, the same fears, the same challenges, the same loves, and between those who don't and are therefore able easily to caricature and sometimes demonize the other. So I think right now that seems to be the distinction that is for me most telling between people who live in a world of diversity, economic, ethnic, religious, and people who live in a world of homogeneity. And I think in a lot of ways in this country, those people are living in different countries.
Paku?
You know, that's a great point, Brian. You know, I was thinking how growing up, I was always in settings where I was the only person of color. And maybe it's also because, you know, I'm an immigrant, my parents are immigrants, but I was always very curious about how other people lived. And I remember asking, you know, what are your Christmas rituals? You know, because we have a Christmas ritual in our family too. We, you know, and I was always not necessarily searching for common ground, Carrie, but just curious about how other people lived. And so in my mind, that became the America, you know, where some people on Christmas morning, they eat, I don't know, quiche. And my family, you know, we would open up our presents and we're Hmong, but we open up our presents, you know, on midnight on Christmas Eve. But to your point, Brian, about that homogeneity, I think also, you know, what is a prerequisite of that is that we need to be curious and we need to be open to learning from each other. And there was a time actually where that was really pervasive, you know, where in rural communities where it was probably very monolithic, exchange students would go to those communities, right? Or those were the communities, even in the political refugee kind of moments in Minnesota, it was those communities that were opening their doors to the Hmong and the Vietnamese, the Cambodian refugees. But we seem to have lost that. And for me, that's not only sad, but I'm perplexed. What happened? Why aren't we as curious about how people live nowadays?
You know, the other thing that I hear in your Christmas morning story there is, it's to understand and maybe take on some of the traditions of the place you're in or the people who have come to that place is not to deny the value of the original tradition.
Completely. That, to me, is what America is that we have something that was a template and then we add on to it and there's a reverberation effect so that not only is the original change, but we also change what used to be coming. So for me as a Hmong person, you know, yes, we have Thanksgiving on, we have at Thanksgiving, we have turkey, but we also have egg rolls. And so, you know, being American.
Sounds like fun.
It is very good. But you're right, though. Being an American changes not only Hmong culture, but it changes what used to be Minnesotan culture. That reverberation, that is America.
But I also think, Naima, that's the scary thing. right?
Yeah. I mean, as you're speaking, Paku, I was thinking a lot about assimilation versus integration.
Yeah.
And I know that there are, you know, a ton of conversations that kind of happen around this. And I've observed, you know, within the Muslim community, it's often about kind of how do you, it's more like that salad bowl analogy, right? Rather than the melting pot. So each, you know, individual component of the salad, like the carrot is still the carrot, the crouton is still the crouton, right? But yet right. You're able to live in this kind of integrated way. And so I think also kind of thinking about how do we create the room and the space to lift up the stories, right, of community that are different from our own. How do we actually engage in a deeper way? Part of the work that I do with Islamic Resource Group is we do a lot of bridge building. We were in Ely just a couple weekends ago with the women of the Lutheran Church in Ely, and it was just a phenomenal example in my life of just sharing just deeply in terms of, you know, religious traditions and really having rich conversation. And I feel like the more of that we can foster and the more of that we can create space for, the better we're served by it.
So one of the things that I've been talking with in the people that we've done the series with is where the idea of American exceptionalism is, that we occupy some kind of special place in the world and that we stand above a lot of other places in the world. Brian, would you reflect on that?
It's unhealthy. I think it's not just fine, but appropriate to feel pride in the place where you live, to feel pride in your country.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to suggest that we are somehow intrinsically better than or different than other people in other places is naturally going to provoke a negative reaction from those other places, and could very easily allow us to become complacent and intellectually lazy. If you just assume you are somehow inherently better, then it's very easy for you to become actually worse. And so I've always pushed back against the notion that simply by virtue of being American, we are different and better than other people in the world. If you look at metrics like the health of our young people, if you look at metrics like the degree of education that we're providing, if you look at the fact that we're about the only industrialized country in the world that doesn't guarantee a woman a leave if she's having a child with pay, that's a kind of exceptionalism that I don't particularly want to embrace. So there are many great things about this country, but to suggest that we are somehow, by virtue of being American, better than everyone else, I think has not served us particularly well.
But I think, you know, it's kind of gospel in a political season. Almost every politician feels the need to assert this at some point during a campaign.
That's why I'm glad I'm not a politician.
Because you'd have to tell the truth about it.
And I think that's the irony, because it is a missed opportunity to learn. I mean, especially around public policy, we look at just the healthcare debate. And if we couldn't examine how other countries do their healthcare system, what a missed opportunity for us to improve ours.
Right.
Or even the justice system. If we don't look at how other countries roll out their laws and their justice, their criminal justice system, how could we improve ours? And in fact, to imply that if you would actually look at international law and use that to support an argument you have here, and how if doing that, that's un-American, that's just preposterous to me. How do we learn from that? You know, it's a missed opportunity.
I think some of the irony in kind of that speech around American exceptionalism, particularly in an election time, is that I think it tries to elevate hope in people, but it does that in a way that doesn't actually speak to the challenges that would ultimately make us better. So if there were some opportunity to say, like, yes, our people are exceptional in that they strive and that we as a nation are aspirational, no doubt we're an economic superpower. And how do we use that all of those resources that we have as a learning opportunity for us? How do we apply what we know are flaws within our systems? Mm-hmm. And how do we actually, you know, make a sum that's greater than all of its parts?
I think this is the reason that I've brought this up in these conversations, is I don't think it's just a thought experiment. I think the idea of it drives leadership and drives decision-making of this government.
It does, yes. And the challenge is to take pride in and embrace those aspects of this country that truly are exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is probably no example in history of a democracy that's existed for as long as this one has, and in as close to a pure form as this one has. Democracies tend not to survive for very long. And the fact that this one has, and it continues to, and it has the opportunity to improve is a great and historically exceptional thing. But the problem becomes when you try to extend that exceptionalism to everything, so that there's nothing that we can do that is wrong. There's nothing that we can do that can be criticized. There's nothing we can learn from other countries. That's when it goes from being sort of a kind of thoughtful understanding of ways in which this country is special to a very thoughtless embrace of everything we do, right or wrong. And it is true, it is a political necessity still in this country for politicians to embrace that. My guess is if you got them alone in a room talking privately, they would say many of the same things that we're saying. But it's a little bit like being a politician and saying you're an atheist. It's not something that this country seems prepared for.
I was going to ask where faith fits into this idea of American identity. Naima, do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I have a thought in response to Brian's comments, so I don't know which one to do first. But
either one.
So, I have a different take on kind of our democracy and the state of our democracy. I don't know that we're quite living up to the democratic ideals as we claim to be nowadays, frankly. And I think that part of the reason why you have such a jaded attitude among the younger voters is because, you know, I feel like there's a sense that we don't know whether the representatives that are claiming to represent us truly actually do a good job of carrying that voice or the multiple voices that they're supposed to represent to the degree that, you know, would make a meaningful difference in the way that political structures kind of operate. And so from that perspective, I mean, I feel like my sense is that so many of my own friends and my own community is kind of jaded in terms of understanding how even the current political, you know, leaders of each party are really going to serve the interests of America well. And so I would beg to differ on just kind of the state in which American democracy is.
You are probably not holding up Congress as a pure example, yeah,
no.
Just to be clear on that, right? Religious faith, though, within this idea.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about how faith plays a role in the American identity for a land that's historically been Christian, right? The founders have a very strong kind of Christian doctrine that they draw upon. And it's fascinating to just kind of think about how that collective understanding is kind of shifting as the number of faith communities and the way that faith communities are showing up and having voices heard now kind of shifts, right? And so being a Muslim American, of course, you know, I can speak endlessly kind of about this topic. To some degree, it's about, you know, who speaks for Islam in America, right? That's one of the key questions that I see many folks struggling with as, you know, we go all across Minnesota and speak with congregations, speak with schools, speak with community centers, we often run into the question of, you know, who is it that, you know, why don't we see Muslims speaking out against these violent acts, right? Violent act X, Y, Z. Why don't we see more Muslim Americans speaking out about this? And I'm just kind of flabbergasted.
I'm sure.
Because
I'm sure
I'm just kind of like...
Because you do see a lot of Muslim Americans speaking out about that.
Not only do we speak out about it at a local level, Carrie, our imams, our institution, like there are whole, you know, nonprofit organizations out there that represent American Muslims at a broader kind of public policy level that are actively and vehemently kind of, you know, speaking out against... acts of terror and violence every time that they happen. And to some degree, members of our community are somewhat frustrated. They're like, we should not need to apologize for things that, you know, we're guilty by association, right? Frankly. So it's not that anything within our faith teaches terrorism. It's not that, you know, that Muslims themselves are somehow more prone to perpetrate acts of terror against others. And so at some level, it's like, how do you know who is speaking for Muslims? Mm-hmm. Because we don't have a central kind of structure, like similar to the church per se.
The go-to being the Pope or something like that, right?
Right. So often I feel like it's hard for people to kind of wrap their heads around, well, okay, then who do you take your cues from? And, you know, it's kind of a difficult story to tell because historically, if you think about just the broader kind of Islamic faith tradition, it was a civilization, right? And it had several rulers and there were several kind of empires throughout history. And there was the caliph. But then the office of the caliph, if you will, was essentially disintegrated. I mean, after World War I, there was no caliphate to speak of. And so what happens is that Muslims, you know, particularly Muslims in America, are now kind of really localized in terms of their understanding of the faith. We often look to Muslim American scholars, right, who are really kind of steeped in the religious studies and are really certified and know what they're talking about in terms mm-hmm. of religious laws and the text, et cetera. And these are deeply knowledgeable people. And they are the bona fide kind of voices that Muslim Americans take their cues from in terms of understanding how to practice on the day-to-day, you know, kind of level.
I think what you're dealing with here in the what don't Americans get about the way we're speaking out and what we're saying and hearing us is the level of ferocity. I think in the kind of world, media world that we live in, ferocity often wins. And to come out with reasonable explanations or things to say often gets drowned out in the noise of the fierceness of the response.
But Carrie, let's also be honest. It's also a double standard, though.
Yeah.
Because when
absolutely
right when
this
we have
whole
a young
thing of
white
needing
man,
to be apologized for absolutely
right. It's marred in privilege and power when the young man, white man, killed all the churchgoers in North Carolina.
Do right.
White people have to defend him? That was never ever even spoke of. So it is a double standard, and it's not fair. And that's also being American. You know, is that we grapple with issues of fairness all the time. You know, when you in political science, when they do studies, they say what are some kind of quintessential American values, and this idea of fairness is right up there. And what's happening is not fair.
Right, Brian.
Well, I would agree, and you know, on the general question of faith in this country, again, it's something we need to acknowledge. It plays a stronger role in the way we govern our country than in almost any other country in the world. I'm a big believer in the fact that government and faith should be separate. And I'm uncomfortable with the extent to which they've become interwoven in this country, particularly around the dominant Christian faith. I think it's just become problematic in the extent to which it has woven itself into public policy decisions where it really shouldn't and where I think the people who founded the country believed it shouldn't. One of the many ways in which we have recreated the myths of America is in the way we've recreated its founding as a Christian nation, as opposed to a nation which had a clear separation between church and state. Somehow that's become very blurred.
Carrie, I just wanted to add something, too, and this goes back to earlier comments that were made about how, you know, what are our current leaders called to do, you know, in this type of, mm-hmm. of discourse? And I'm reminded that just in the same way that we have a representative democracy, a representative republic, we don't have a direct republic. And so we do need educated – or let me take it back. We need engaged citizens to be involved in civic life. But we also do need these enlightened statesmen, you know, and I know there's a gender part, but we need these enlightened leaders who are transforming, you know, their roles and seeing the larger. And I think right now about the Republican Party and how can you say someone's comments are racist, that what they're saying is racist, and then you don't disavow that. For me, you know, and yes, I'm a Democrat, but I'm sure that Paul Ryan is a good person. He wants to serve his country, and I support that. But internally, I struggle with, you know, how can you say to someone, what you're saying is really racist, but I'm still going to support you. And I can see maybe where some people would say, you know, I don't like the words, but I still believe in him. But for me, it's been a real struggle, especially with how vehement some of the language has been.
I think you're tapping in again to where integrity fits into the essence of what the ideals of being an American and how you have to express those, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, it's integrity has not been as abundantly clear in the last several months as I think many of us would like. And I very much agree. I have struggled to no end with this question of how you can say things like that is the textbook definition of racism, or how you can condemn sexual harassment and at the same time say, but I support that person for what is almost inarguably the most powerful position in the world. The message that delivers is so deeply problematic that I don't know how people who occupy that space can continue to occupy that space. It's a real. I understand why they're doing it for political reasons, but I don't have a lot of admiration for it.
I thank you all for a provocative and really interesting roundtable. Thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.